we're feeling a little sleepy from what they're telling you. So let's do, we'll go into a more subtle breath in a little bit, but let's do this. Let's take a deep breath. And Rashida Vera would always tell us to take a deep breath in and then take three more sips of air. Okay? And then we're going to use the word ah. And we're going to exhale every bit of air. And she would also tell us to bend over a little bit just to get a little extra air out. So this is how it'll go. I'll demonstrate and then you can follow. So it's taking a deep breath in. Ah, all the way out. In. Three sips. Ah. In. Sip. By the way, the word ah, you know when someone's rubbing your back and it feels really good and you know, or something else is going on, you know, it's the seed syllable for enlightened speech.
It's what?
The seed syllable for enlightened, the Buddha's enlightened speech. That symbol resides here in the throat. Ah, isn't that nice? The bowl's responding differently. Are people more awake? Mm-hmm. Huh? A little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. I feel the impulse, not just the impulse, but I will willfully say this as well. And the Marcia makes a distinction between impulse and will. The bowls are very interesting, and I talked a little bit about the metals and their healing properties. I often find people are, this is like a temple. You know, this is a temple. And you know, that we have these wheels in our body, you know, these energy wheels. And it's very important that the kinds of motions that we make around our body. And because it can make the wheels go in the proper direction. If they're in the improper direction, it can create congestion, it can and ultimately lead to disease. And this bowl, again, can be used both ways. One is to draw energies into the body, and that is a clockwise direction, or some people call that sunwise. And to extract things out of the body is counterclockwise. But traditionally, and most often, the bowl is played in this direction, sunwise, like clockwise direction. And our chakras, those wheels of energy, spin in that direction. As if we're the post of the clock and the hands are going this way around the body. So you can see where that would have a balancing effect. I've seen people pick them up and go this way. It's not that it's wrong, but one should understand. Now I'd like to say another word. This is also the direction that we go around the temples in India, Hindu temples and Buddhist temples. If you see them going around the Kaaba, it's the opposite direction. Interesting. But even when we clean the bowls, we move the hands in a direction that's also, it's very, always mindfulness, mindfulness to this direction. So the bowls are always cleaned and moved in that way too. And you've seen Buddhist offering altars where they have the seven different cups for offerings, and that's also done in that way. The bowls are never left empty. When they are finished washing, they're turned upside down as a respect, so they're not empty. And then also, when you're filling the bowls, you fill the first bowl full, and pour a little bit into the next bowl and put it down, and a little bit into the next bowl and put it, and then you fill all of them. So you're such a beautiful service. And the offerings are seven. They represent the offerings in the East. When someone comes to your home, you offer them water to wash your feet, their feet, and you offer them water to drink, and you offer them perfumed oils, and you offer them food, and you offer them fragrance, and you offer them light, and you offer music. So these are all representing these. When you see those altars, that's what signifies. Face the east. Today we'll do the Salat, which is the noon prayer, the other pillar of the Sufi message. So those that know the movement, stand up.
First, we'll begin with the invocation again. Hands are cupped at the solar plexus, receiving. Pour upon us that thy love and thy light, filling and healing this gold, of these words, this message. Towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the luminous souls, who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of our kindness. After we feel the receptive hands, we raise our hands up. We're raising the energy through the central channel, and then we're allowing this light and this vibration from this prayer to flow over our aura field. Also, that it's important to tell you that Khosrow Maikon said that the prayer should be said with eyes open, looking straight ahead. I think mostly that was for the service that we saw in an informal way yesterday, the universal worship ones, always concentrating on the divine light, that main candle. And so the eyes are always directed in that way. And of course, you know, if I go like this, you're going to start looking over there, right? So it's wherever, if I'm facilitating in some ways, where my attention is directed, you'll also direct your attention. And that's one of the roles of the Shirag, is to offer that subtle direction to the participants. And in the morning prayer we said yesterday, and we said it twice, when the prayer says, the seen and the unseen beings, the eyes are open, the seen and then the unseen beings, and then they're open and we draw. But today we're doing another prayer. Most gracious Lord, Master, Messiah, and Savior of humanity, we greet thee with all humility. Thou art the first cause and the last effect, the divine light and the spirit of guidance, Alpha and Omega,
Thy light is in all forms, thy love in all needs, in a loving mother, in a kind father, in an innocent child, in a helpful friend, in an inspiring teacher.
I think we're going to go through a list of names. And when you say the name, pause for one moment and take an inhalation. Because the names represent the masculine vibration. And if you take an inhalation, you are offering the homage to the feminine receptive vibration, the counterpart. It's the consciousness without even being able to change the word to understand. Allow us to recognize thee in all thy holy names and forms as Rama, as Shiva, as Buddha. Let us know thee as Abraham, as Solomon, as Zarathustra, as Moses, as Jesus, as Muhammad. In this prayer, it is the universal worship in its entirety. No wonder he would call that prayer one of the pillars of the message. Beautiful, just by saying that prayer every day. We're performing the universal worship, and then the affirmation at the end. And it's said at 11:45 is the prescribed time when the sun is at its zenith. May the message of God reach far and wide. How extraordinary is that? You see, there's such subtlety and beauty to the prayers. It's not blah, 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 okay, now let's do something else. If we understand that, to me, it's the technology. The breath and the prayers are the technology. They're going to get you where you want to go. If you know where it is, you're going to want to go. I have an idea. But how extraordinary when you understand we just perform universal worship. The consciousness is very high, the sun is at its zenith, and then we'll use the affirmation at the end to make a message of God reach far and wide. Christ, Nabi, the Rosary of God, thou who holds hard constantly in the sacrament. Thou comest from earth with a message as a dove from above, and armed in days, and speaks the glory that is put into thy hand as a light filled with precious moon. May the star of the divine light shining in thy heart be reflected in your heart's dark abilities. May the message of God be far and wide. Illuminating and make the whole humanity as one single brotherhood in the fatherhood of God. The hands come together, one single brotherhood in the fatherhood. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God reach far and wide. May the message of God
through each heart and your mind. May the message of God reach far and wide.
So today I'd like to offer the first day we did the purification breath, and yesterday we did the elemental breaths, and today I'd like to introduce another breath, which isn't, at least for me, it wasn't something that I was very aware of until a few years ago, and this is called the triangle breath. And in this breath, we're going to do a visualization. In the beginning, the triangle is pointing upward. We visualize it here in the form of light. And in the second series of breaths, the triangle will reverse like this. Is that right? Okay. And we're going to be following the triangle with, you can even sort of trace it inwardly with your eyes because the practice is done closed eyes. And we'll go one way and then we'll go the other. And we're going to alternate the breath in the nostrils. This is very simple, but here is the deal. This is really, I think people that have been doing it could testify that it's a very profound breath. And it is, and maybe we'll have a little sharing because people have had some wonderful experiences and very practical ways of using the breath. See, this is the thing. This is, we practice so we can be practical. You see? And then we integrate the practice into every moment of our lives. Right? And so it's not something we do and then we squeeze in and then we're off to the races. But it's something if we're practiced and we're studied, we can use it and we can apply it when we need it. So this breath is this breath in the first version is said to promote. I have to go back. This is the wrong one. This is the one we want to do first. This breath is the breath that we use if we wish to accomplish something. If we wish to accomplish something. And something that requires some willpower, that we need to use one's will for it. So we're going to be beginning with, it's interesting in these practices, this set of practices, it always begins with the Jalal breath, which is the masculine breath, which is the powerful breath. And then we go to the receptive. So a little bit, and I made this analogy the other day, it's not so true now in this moment because we're a little wearier than we have been on other days. But at any rate, often when we come to the practices, the mind can be scattered or there can be an energy buildup, And I think that when we have those energy builds up, that's when it comes out as frustration or anger because it's like the pressure valve needs to be released. And so if there's a medium to doing that, and the breaths is a very good medium, exercise is good, yelling in a pillow or beating one is also good. Whatever that is, but sometimes just exhausting that energy, then you fall into a state of relaxation, right? That's why so many teachers can, if they're very conscious, you know, especially we see this in Tibetan Buddhism, these great challenges that the teacher gives to the student. And then the student falls into this exhausted state and they're illuminated because they have to let it all go. So we're expending any excess energy that may be there, you know, and then we go into the other dimension of the breath. So, and we only do the breath very short. It's four breaths in. So I'm going to draw that. We're going to go this way. Four breaths in. Four breaths hold. Four breaths down. Four breaths in. Four breaths across. No, that's not true. I'm so sorry. It's four breaths in, holding to the count of four. Four count out. Four count, not breaths. Four count in, hold to the count of four, out to the count of four. You've got that?
Mm-hmm. And that's to the right then.
We start on the left and we go to the right. Left, hold, right. Left, hold, right. We're not alternating. Yeah. Yeah, I'm opposite.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, you have to reverse that because I'm sitting facing. Now, you might want to take just a moment before we do the first breath and contemplate, is there something that's waiting out there after Sufi camp that we hope to be able to accomplish? It could be something very small. It could be something very big. I don't know. It could be potting a new plant, or it could be, you know, activating a merger of companies. I don't know what it is. But it can have a great influence. I'll give you a personal example. At the college, we've been trying to negotiate in this economic downturn where there's been a hiring freeze for a number of years. The hiring freeze was handled in this way. When anyone left their job or retired, they were at least replaced. Now those jobs are eliminated. There's an $8.7 million budget cut, and everyone's tightening their purse strings. And it's hurting. And we have gone through a long project. We've received funding through the president's office. This breath, I think, has done that. A sizable amount to hire an outside, internationally known designer to come in to do a consultant and an audit. We just found out Friday before coming down, we have the position. And it's being funded in an unusual way. The president has funds at his disposal, and he's personally funding this until we can get through this difficulty in terms of our net economic situation. In addition, he's funded secretarial staffing. So this is very unusual. No one else is really getting these benefits at the college, but with this breath and holding that concentration. Of course, I do all my novenas to St. Anthony and St. Jude and all the miracle saints too. I pray to all my teachers and make offerings. But this breath is really very good because it helps to sharpen one's concentration about these things. Have you done this breath before, Lynn?
It is very much like the Latte Eve practice.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Practice.
Yes.
It's this, though. It's
okay.
Not just,
there.
It's not just in this area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very interesting. And just to say a little bit about concentrating on this area, yesterday I spoke, as we did the elemental breaths, the stimulation that's happening when we concentrate here, the fluid is rising in the spinal column, comes to the cerebral cortex, then it goes onward on its journey, stimulating the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the pineal gland. So there's very physiological reasons why the concentration's remaining in this area during this practice. Okay, so take a moment and just see if something naturally arises that you're wishing to accomplish that may require a little mastery Your will, your concentration. This is worldly. We'll go inward in a little bit, but first just something tangible that we wish to accomplish. We will close off the right nostril and we'll breathe out to the count of four. 1, 2, 3, 4, in left. Hold. Out right. In left. Hold. Out right. The triangle is pointing downwards. In left. Hold. Out right. And just relax. Going to a natural breath. We'll reverse this motion, again triangle pointing downward. But here, we'll be going to the Jamal state. This is the state that is beauty and harmony and gracefulness. So the one is power and might. And the other one is the gentle response to that, the reflection of beauty and harmony. So on the one hand, we're concentrating on something we wish to accomplish externally, but we're drawing upon this internal resource. We're becoming receptive so that we might have some revelation of how to accomplish that. Does that make sense? Because if we just use will all the time, we exhaust ourselves, our nervous systems become wrecked. And there has to be some sort of balance. So now we've concentrated on what this is we want to have come to fruition externally, but now we're seeking insight, maybe another approach than what we would usually do. Okay. So again, the triangle's pointing downward. We'll begin by closing off the left nostril. And we breathe out. 2, 3, 4, in right. Hold. Out left. In right. Hold. Out left. In right. Hold. Out left. Just sit and be open for a few moments. When we do these practices, they keep doing their work, even if in the moment we're not getting any particular message or insight. You'll see, it will have its effect. The next breath, the next dimension of this breath, the completion of this whole cycle, is now the triangle is upwards. The base is here. And you're visualizing it here in the form of light. Typically white light, although if one's concentrating on a particular elemental, you can bring that color in. It's very interesting, another aspect of the practice. By the way, the 7 days of the week have astrological components, and they have colors of the spectrum. And so that is also a very good concentration to bring in each day of the week. I plan my wardrobe that way when I travel, because Monday is white for moon day, Tuesday is red, Mars, Wednesday is green, Thursday is orange colors, variations of that, Friday is gray, Saturday is black or deep purples and blues, and Sunday is, of course, yellow or orange or Sunday. Fun. Very interesting. And then you're harmonizing. If you notice, you'll start to see, well, there are a lot of people kind of wearing those colors, you know. And that we do it naturally without knowing. So now here, we again begin with the Jalal breath. In, left, out right, then hold on the out breath. It's different. In, left, out right, hold on the out breath. And here we're asking, you see, this is very interesting. First we wish to accomplish something, then we open to the receptivity of how that might be accomplished in a way that we're not accustomed to, and now we're going to the development of the skill to overcome some aspect of ego that gets in the way or thinks it knows all the answers. And again, I think these practices will have their natural, but there may be something that as you're doing the breath comes up, oh, yeah, I kind of see that that's a little cycle that I get caught in. And, you know, offering that into the breath. Trying the breath. Okay? So we'll close off the right nostril. We'll breathe out the left nostril first, just to begin to get, so we can get a fresh breath in. So breathe out. 2, 3, 4, in left, out right, hold, in left, out right, hold. In left, out right, hold, and just relax. The next breath, which completes the cycle, is meant to awaken something within. This is a characteristic of our soul that we wish to awaken and enliven. So in a way, you can see we've gone from the very concrete and we're going inwardly to the more subtle dimensions of the being, which is it's the work that you're doing with Bilal, I think, isn't it? So you start there, and then you go inward. Okay. Sometimes we start inward, and we go outward. That's also a good practice. But this is different, you see. So here we can just merely set the intention that something, we become aware of something perhaps latent in our being that we wish to bring forward, to give birth to. Again, the triangle is pointing upward, and we're following that, the lines of the triangle. We start by closing off the left nostril, and we breathe out through right, 2, 3, 4, three, four, in right, out left, hold, in right, out left, hold, in right, out left, hold. And just relax. The paper that I'd like to share today was, well, the paper from yesterday that we didn't get to. But this is from, again, you know, I remind you that Hazrat Anayat Khan departed the earth on February 5th, 1927. The paper that we read on Saturday was from July. And this one is from September. September 3rd, 1926. Getting closer to his leaving in the physical form. This also is noted that it was given on Friday. I told you that about the last paper. And he says, I'd like to say something about the Sufi manner of sympathy. It is the first and most essential thing for the Sufi to have a sympathetic attitude towards all. And by towards all, I mean towards those who expect sympathy, towards those who will be helped by sympathy, and towards those who do not yet deserve, and yet it's better to give them sympathy. But now there's another question. In what way must you show your sympathy? See, that's how he always does it. He sets you up, and then he comes about it in another way. You must be ready to show your sympathy where it's welcomed. And you must be able to keep your sympathy for a time in some cases when it will be welcomed for that time. And you may give your sympathy without making the other person know of it. The real sympathy doesn't need any manifestation. All the expression of words and actions, all these expressions must follow sympathy, but sympathy must not follow them. The greatest sympathy that one can show to anyone is the regard for that person's pleasure and displeasure. And that is the first lesson. And most often people try to learn the last lesson and omit the first. Everybody is anxious to become perfect at once. As soon as they feel sympathy in their heart, they want it to be complete. But in reality, sympathy must grow slowly, It must be reared. It must be watered. Where there's a deep sympathy, there is not even so much profitable to another person as it is to oneself. And that sympathy, which is for reciprocity, is worthless from a higher point of view. You understand? Yeah, it's
good. Read the last two lines again.
No. The last two lines again. But in reality, is that where you want me to go?
I think.
But in reality, sympathy must grow slowly. It must be reared. It must be watered. Here is interesting, because you see, I'll give you an example that comes to mind, if you allow me. There's a story of a man that went to India, a Westerner, and he went and he was meeting with Mother Krishnabai, and he said, I am so overwhelmed by the poverty that I see here. You see, it was sympathy. That I really want to give everything away. I want to give all my clothes and all my money and everything to help. Well, what could that do in a country of, billion people? Not very much. And she said, well, you know, you must always give from your interest and not your principle. You understand? So it's like we have to understand, and this is the next line. It's the first line, where sympathy must grow slowly, it must be reared, it must be watered, and it relates to this triangle breath, because we can, by using that breath, get a greater insight, perhaps develop a greater capacity. I, by myself, can't do very much, but if I can get other people interested towards a cause, I can do a whole lot more. You see what I'm saying? It's an example. And also, have you ever had anyone, you know, just something awful's happened in your life, and people know it, and I'm sorry to say, but I think sometimes people delight in it. You know, bad news travels far better than good news. And so, you know, and then people come up and it's like, oh, are you okay? Is everything all right? You know, that doesn't do you any good, does it? I mean, maybe it does you, it doesn't me, I don't like it, but I say, I'm fine. It doesn't help me. But if someone says, you know, I can't understand what's happening, I'm here to support you. If you need anything, let me know. That's helpful. You know, and my Tibetan friends, they always write and say, we're offering you in prayer our courage. Have a happy heart no matter what's going on. Have courage. This teaches courage. So this, you know, being crippled by things, of course we naturally crumble and then we can build up like Humpty Dumpty. We have to crash sometimes. But it doesn't hurt for people to be there always giving that weepy energy to us. Giving us a little strength and courage is helpful, I think. But this is my perspective, which is limited also. So where there is deep sympathy, it is not even so much profitable to another person as it is to oneself. And that sympathy, which is for reciprocity, is worthless from a higher point of view. So here he's saying to have the heart open, to have it overflowing, to have this feeling of sympathy is very beneficial for us. From the Buddhist point of view, that's called bodhicitta, a compassionate mind, an awakened compassionate mind. That's a great benefit for us. And sometimes it's also, you know, there's great benefit just in prayer. That's an action. We talked about that another day. But it sets up a vibration. I'm really interested in these physicists that are, you know, they're doing this study on string theory. It's phenomenal. So if we think about that and that, what is his name? Kaku, he's at university in New York. I mean, I think we should be inviting him to camp. He'd be so fabulous. Because he talks about spirituality from the point of view of pure science. And he says, this whole manifestation is a great symphony. And it changes in appearance based on the vibration of the string. It's amazing. That's pure Hazar and Anayat Khan, the mysticism of sound and vibration. And so if that's true, then our offering a prayer, our offering this feeling of sympathy, is changing the world. I mean, maybe that is our doing. It's not getting out there and, you know, it's that, offering that thought, that vibration. And now, well, I'm skipping that part, shall I? Maybe I won't.
No, the last sentence you reread, I'm still not quite sure I'm grasping what he's saying. I'm sorry to interrupt, but he's, the very last phrase, he's saying from a higher perspective, this is not his perspective.
If we're giving our sympathy with the expectation that someone says, oh, look at how great that person is, they're so sympathetic, they're doing something so wonderful, then we're expecting some payment. How is that doing any good for anyone? There's an expectation. Or when you know, my mother always tells me, and you've probably heard this too, the mark of the character of a person is what they do alone, not what they do in front of people.
But why don't you give it in the recognition that as you extend that sympathy, you can not only help the other, but it also helps yourself.
That's the first line he's saying. I mean, it is profitable for oneself.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yes. And you know, it's a good idea. I like this from the Buddhist perspective. And Nikon, we've seen this in some teachings, and I've talked about it during other classes. It's very clear he had that study because he uses some of the seed syllables, even in the healing service, that come directly from Tibetan Buddhism. But at any rate, Tibetan Buddhism, not other forms, Tibetan. But at any rate, that idea of doing something and then offering it, that virtue to the benefit of others is a great, really great practice to be mindful of. And even when you see, you know, like we were admiring your beauty yesterday, and that's also very good to offer. Oh, my eyes are filled with this vision, and I don't want to hold this for myself. I, you know, silently to offer that to others is really good. Or tasting good food. Oh, may all beings be benefited with this beautiful savor. You know, or may all beings be benefited with nice clothing or the comfort of being loved or, you know, whatever that is, just to be mindful of not holding on to it. That's also a form of sympathy to put that prayer and that wish out. Charles, you were...
No, I think you just touched on it. The wanting a reward with sympathy. Yeah, to me, that internal reward is it. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't need to be external. It's a very great form of selfishness. You can be unbelievably selfish by being generous.
You know,
and in fact, the less other people know about it, the more selfish you are.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that you would bring that up. And in you know, I do this work with Tibetan refugees, and they're always just like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's like, no, I need to thank you because you're giving me such an amazing opportunity to accumulate vast amounts of merit by serving and helping in this way. I mean, it's extraordinary. And, you know, in an interesting way, if you start to look at life as you see that one person's suffering is another person's opportunity to offer something, and then these people that we see are suffering and downtrodden are really the great saints that are teaching us how to have these sensitive feelings and to take these actions, and then we learn how to be more gentle and caring and see the suffering in the world, and it's this beautiful dance that it's all of benefit, you know. And we project. I'll tell you, some of the happiest people I've seen are living under black trash bags poked up with sticks. So, you know, it's a matter of perspective, too. I mean, really happy. They can laugh, they can offer a kind word, and when you don't have anything, you don't worry about it getting taken away from you, right? You're just in the moment. Here's a good one. And then the way how one can help one's, here he's speaking about comrades, but we can say our fellow brothers and sisters, is that those who stand in need of some service, some help, some advice, some assistance, you give them. Give it, if it's obvious. And those who do not stand in need of anything, leave them alone. It's so practical, you know, and it's interesting, too, because if we're always out there, the energy is always out there looking out there, well, then we rarely are looking here. So he says, but if a person is standing in a garden of the summer school and you, out of your sympathy, thought that he must be brought tea, maybe that person will become ill by drinking that tea. You know, we're imposing our will on someone. It's like you're going to be kind and meritorious. Maybe they're also deep in meditation. We disturb them. He's not standing there looking at a tree to get tea. You know, here is his humor. He's not standing there looking at a tree to get tea. I mean, how practical, but he's very humorous, you know. He's standing there in his own thought. Perhaps he's meditating. By giving his tea, you're doing no good at all. Therefore, kindness must be bestowed in a place when and where there is a need. Suppose a person is sitting under the shade of a tree, perhaps meditating upon a word that he's heard from Murshid, and you go near him and you say, I want to know what's the trouble with you. How many people have experienced that? If you're just sort of sober, you have a sense of sobriety, you're not just, hi, you know, and they're like, what's wrong with you? Are you sad? Are you, you know, has it happened? Yeah. It's like, get the fuck away from me. Do you feel like, I mean, I say it, you probably just think it. Fuck off.
People who try to be too helpful. What
yes.
are you looking for?
Yes.
But, you know,
yes.
Well, I'm doing this. This is my...
That's right. That's right. And you know, I've learned a really great lesson by being with my teachers that are elders, too. It's not also so nice if you think you're helping them. It's always very polite. Is there something, may I help you with something? Is there something I can do to... Because if you all of a sudden are taking their arms, it makes them feel crippled.
Yeah.
You see, so we think we're being helpful, but it's giving an impression like, oh, you seem so fragile and things. It's not so conscious. We think it is. It's not. They're sitting there and you say, I want to know what the trouble is with you. What's the matter with you? I feel sympathy with you. I would like to know. What's the matter with you? He keeps going on. I feel sympathy with you. I'd like to know. I want to help you. He will say, if you feel sympathy towards me, please leave me alone. I'm meditating and I'm quite happy. Therefore, sympathy must have a sense with it. Wherever sympathy is needed, there it must be given, and there is the value of it. This is a really good lesson, isn't it? I think it's true at camp, too, because I just think we want to connect with people. So anyway, this is it. Can I read a few questions and answers?
Okay.
Huh? Oh, if you must, you can go. I love these little interactions what Murshid has with his students. So he says, the question is, do you not think it's a good form of giving sympathy to let the person not feel that the person is in want of it? It's a little funny phrasing. Do you not think it's a good form of giving sympathy to let the person not feel that the person is in want of it? This is a little bit what we talked about. And he said, answer, in what way can you? It means sometimes it is possible to help him without him noticing that he is helped, and that is the best help. That is always the most valuable help. He says, this is interesting. Must one not in the first case obey one's own intuitions? Must we not obey our own intuitions? And he says, answer, well, it depends. Sometimes one feels that it's an intuition, but it is nothing but a kind of impression. One day, perhaps, more than 20 persons, 20 of my murids, each one thought that it was their intuition, that it was their inner voice, but it was nothing but a deep psychological impression of one person. And all 20 took fire. They all thought very sincerely that it was their intuition. So sometimes there are, you know, he gives a great deal of emphasis in some of his teachings about the impressions of the mind, you know, and they can rise up, or these are kind of reflections. And so it's really very good when we talked the first day about, in the purification breath, understanding one's natural rhythm and feeling one's own vibration. Only when we do this can we be very clear. Is this an impression that's coming up, or is it some reflection from outside that I'm absorbing and responding to? And this is the reason for these purification breaths. It can eradicate those lines, those impressions. You know, it's like Sufis always say, polishing the mirror of the heart. Well, what does that mean? It means clearing away that dust, those impressions, those scratches, those marks, you see, so that it's just a reflection. Everything's clear. Clear mind. He says this, question, how can one tell the difference between psychological impression and intuition? Answer, the difference is that the more self-confidence you have, the more intuitive faculty develops.
Can I read that one more time?
Yeah. The question is, how can you tell the difference between a psychological impression and intuition? And he says, the difference is that the more self-confidence you have, the more intuitive faculty develops. There's a kind of certainty. And there's a vibration there that we, again, can understand. Is this a string from here, or did someone pluck it over there and I'm getting the vibration? You understand? It's very subtle. I'm telling you, these new physicists, they really understand it. They're unraveling the mystery of the universe. Well, I think there's one more little question and answer, okay? Is it okay? If you need to go, you can. The question is, what is the greatest illness of this present time? The answer. I think the greatest illness is the thought of self. A person who is concerned with his own self is more ill than any ill person in the world. And at the same time, you cannot make him believe that he's ill because he thinks that everyone else is ill but himself. That's really, truly, that I think is one of the defining characteristics of someone that is really mentally ill, where they think everyone else is wrong and they are right, isn't it, Rahima? Yeah. Because he considers himself to be practical, someone who has common sense, is concerned with his one interest, with his own self, and if he sees another person who forgets his interest and who is devoted to another person, who sacrifices himself to another person, for him it seems that that person is mad. He's lost his head. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, about this manner of discipleship, nirvikship. Our attitude towards our teachers and the teachings. Because another person must be as self-centered as this person is in order for him to recognize him as a man of common sense. So birds of the feather flock together, right? We're always sort of seeking that, a common vibration in some ways, so that we, you know, we don't see things distorted. The minute another contrary vibration comes up, then we feel that the mirrors become distorted and we start fighting it. We want to kill it, and we want to draw those things that reflect what we want to us. It's a very interesting aspect of life. Therefore, not only many, but most of the people are in that condition of spirit today. It's a kind of general attitude. It is the curse of this age, this iron age. And we're talking just coming out of the Industrial Revolution. Things are getting very industrialized. That everyone thinks to be a man of common sense or to be clever or to be wise, that means to guard one's own interest. But to sacrifice for another, to have sympathy for another, to give up one's pleasure and comfort and convenience and interest for another, he thinks that is simply mad. It is mad to be so. And therefore, if one finds the remedy for this, it seems that one finds the remedy for the whole world. And it's said in the Gayan that self-pity is the worst poverty. There is no greater poverty than when a person says, "My poor self, how terrible. In what a terrible situation I am." Okay, if we don't go away with anything else, self-pity is the worst poverty. I have two more lines. Then a person thinks that he's the poorest man in the world. How much richness he has, and how much comfort. Nothing counts as soon as he thinks, "My poor self." He's gone to the depth of the earth. But the whole Sufi teaching, the whole esoteric teaching, wherefore is it given? To remove the false self in order to bring the real self. By the way, Murshid tells in one of the papers that when you're doing a practice, to bring it to mindfulness just before eating your meal, because when you take that in, it's like that you've magnetized your food with that thought, with that impression, and when you eat it, it circulates through your whole body. So here we'll be mindful of that, and we'll say the prayer. O thou, the sustainer of
our bodies, hearts, and souls, bless all that we receive in thankfulness.
Murshid Khan tells us his mother was American, you know that. Or a Ray Baker, a Peronian veteran. And he said, they'd always say, "Amen," at the end of the prayers at the dinner tables. Imagine they're all there, you know, my Han sitting there, the mother, the brothers, you know, any guests, Marines or whatever. And she always had the children say, "Amen, cousin Ben chased a goose and killed a hen."
And I was like, wow, okay. It was a little saying they did. It was funny. It was very sweet.
Taste a goose and killed a hen.